Okay, Erev Tov, everybody, welcome, and a pleasure, really, and an honor to welcome Rabbanit Chana Henkin. And you see the picture of her husband in the background, her late husband, Major Posek. Rabbanit Henkin really needs no introduction, but I think you have to really, really thank her for being one of the pioneers of women's Torah education in general in Israel. She made Aliyah with her husband, I believe, in 1972. Lived in Beit Shan, and of course came up with the idea through the how few people were asking issues, questions on the Torah HaMishpacha, and developed, of course, the Yotzot Halakha program, which is now worldwide. And I guess so I have the honor. Our daughter just got accepted into the program to start in a few months. So I want to thank you and looking forward. And really the impact you've made around the world is honor is a pleasure to see, and you deserve a remarkable Yashar Koach, and together with your husband, I know in the background, but I think without your husband, I'm not sure the program would have ever gotten off the ground and really serving as the rabbinic backbone. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to speak on your husband, and we should be zoche to celebrate many happy occasions moving forward. Vakashav, Rabbanit Henkin.
Thank you. I see many familiar names, and I wish to greet everyone who's there, whom I haven't had the pleasure of seeing in person for many years in Toronto, but I see many familiar names, some in Israel, and particularly I see my cousin, Professor David Henkin, and I wish to greet him, and I wish to greet all of you personally. Okay. Our community knows how to raise Talmidei Chachamim. We've done a good job. We know how to raise rabbis. I think we've done a very good job. We know how to raise Rashi Yeshiva. We have precious few poskim who have come from our community or who address our community. And that's the reason that I decided that I wanted to talk about this evening. There's a legacy here. And my interest is not so much in the legacy being recognized, although it certainly deserves to be, but my interest is in the legacy continuing. What's a posek? My husband used to say there are three elements. One of them is called halakha. Another is called mitziyut, the reality, prevailing conditions. The bridge between the two is psika, is hora'ah. And that's the work of a posek, drawing the connection between halakha and the generation and the prevailing conditions. To do that, you need erudition. Posek is generally an individual of brilliance, of very considerable erudition. One needs clarity of thought. One needs more than anything else to understand how to balance all the factors. You're not putting on the scales this pile of opinions and that pile of opinions. You're factoring all together. And to do so demands an individual who is able to fulfill lo taguru mipnei ish. Do not fear people, be fearless. Otherwise, you're not going to end up being a posek. If what you're doing is you're shooting an arrow and then you're going to draw the target around it, you're not going to be a successful posek. You may or may not be a successful rabbi, I'm not sure, but it's not what a posek should be doing. The work of a posek is shikul hadat, balancing the factors, and I'll try to describe that in another number of tshuvot that I'll go through this evening. You're welcome to ask questions. I understand from Rabbi Kelman that there's going to be a time at the end in which we can interact with each other. My husband used to say in the name of his grandfather, the great and saintly Rabbi Henkin, that the Torah says you should go to Hashofet Asher Yiyeh Bayamim Haheim, the judge who is in that time. You obviously cannot go to a judge who was a judge 200 years ago, and you can't go to a judge who will be a judge in another 50 years. So the way my husband's grandfather, Rabbi Henkin, interpreted this is it's a mitzvah upon the judge to be in his times, to know his times, to know his community, in order to be able to reconcile the different factors and the different needs. When you open my husband's tshuvot, and I'm going to leaf through them with you briefly, you find something very interesting. The tshuvot are addressed to, I'm going to just read a couple, L'Rav Shel Yishuv Echad, to the rabbi of a certain community. I'm starting with volume one. Volume one was during our years in Beit She'an, and very typically the questions came from rabbis of communities. My husband was then rabbi of the Beit She'an Valley, reaching up through the Jordan Valley towards the Golan. So rabbis of communities would consult him. L'Rav Shel Yishuv Echad, to the rabbis of a certain, to the rabbi of a certain yishuv, L'Va'adat Shel Kibbutz Echad, to the religious affairs committee of a particular kibbutz, L'Lomdei Yeshivat Erev B'Beit She'an, L'Chaver Kolel B'Moshav Echad, to a member of a kolel in a particular moshav, L'Rabbanei Makom Echad, to the rabbis of a particular place, L'Rav Orech Echad, L'Rav Shel Makom Echad, L'Rav Echad. This comes over and over and over, L'Rav Echad, L'Rav Echad. In later volumes, you see Le'isha Echad. I think that's the only time you find this in response to literature, that there's a tshuva, a halachic tshuva, not advice. There's a wonderful tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein that gives advice to a certain woman who is asking a question about her daughter who is depressed, and Rabbi Feinstein says you should be supporting her. But that's an advice question. I think this is the only time that there is a tshuva written to Le'isha Achat, to a particular woman. There are several tshuvot, L'talmidot Shem Midrasha Achat, to the students in a particular institute of women's learning. That's generally, nishmat la'avreich echad, le'lamdan echad, le'gadol echad, to a particular gadol. That's a very interesting address, le'gadol echad. Now, in order to understand what's so special about this, you have to be able to look at other sfarim. If you go back to the Middle Ages, take, for instance, Tshuvot HaRashba. In Rashba's responsa, he typically will write, the Rashba will typically write katavta or sha'alta vishalta sha'alta sha'alta. He doesn't identify speaker. If you look at Rabbi Feinstein, on the other hand, in his Igrot Moshe, so you get the geography of the community in which turns to Rabbi Feinstein. Lichvod ma'alat kvodo yididi harav hagaon morenu harav rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt Shlita, the Rivervot Ephraim from Memphis. Or another one is lichvod ma'alat kvodi yididi harav Yaakov Dardik. Every single tshuva tells, or almost every tshuva, to my son, Rev Ruvain, to here's another one, Lichvod Ma'alat Kvodo Bni Ahuvi, Morenu Harav David, his Rabbi David Feinstein, Morenu Harav Moshe Yaakov Perel Shlita, Yedidi Harav Hagaon, Morenu Harav Rav Noach Isaac Applebaum, Shlita. I think it's Applebaum. Elbaum, excuse me, Elbaum Shlita. And here's another one to Rav Gedalia Felder. And Rav Feinstein goes on that way in answer after answer. Rav Ovadia Yosef chooses typically the format of the medievals. And his tshuvot begin with the words, v'nish'alti, I was asked. What made Rabbi Yehuda Henkin decide, I'm going to specify where the question came from, but I'm not going to specify who asked me the question? He gave three reasons for this. One reason, he doesn't write this, but this is what he stated orally. One reason is that he was not a fan of inflated titles. Rav HaGaon, HaRav HaGaon, HaGadol, Rashke Behag, Rabban Shel Kol Beit Yisrael, the titles which have become inflated over the years. And he didn't want to deal with which rabbi receives this title and which rabbi receives that title and how many initials you put after the name. A second reason, which is probably more germane, is that very many of the questions that he was asked were deeply sensitive and not always would the person wish to expose that he was asking the question, he or she. Then there's a third reason, and I believe it's because there were times that my husband wished to be intensely critical of the questioner, but did not wish to shame him publicly. And I'll give you an example of that. And for that reason, he didn't specify the name. Why did he, on the other hand, make the decision that he was going to say L'Rav Echad, to one rabbi, to a L'Lam Dan Echad, to a learned person, L'Ishacha, to a woman who is asking, because there's no such thing as one size fits all when it comes to answering a halachic question. You have to factor in the very specific situation, the specific community. If you don't know that a question came from a kibbutz, how can you possibly understand the answer? The types of questions that my husband dealt with went all the way from the intensely personal to many, many questions involving public policy. Public policy could be something like murdering a bound terrorist. This was a tshuva that caused my husband a great deal of grief because he wrote this initially as an article as a result of something that occurred. There was a terrorist made his way into a yeshuv. He was caught, he was bound, and then someone shot him to death when he was already bound. And my husband wrote a tshuva explaining why this is intolerable for halacha, that there's a tremendous chilul Hashem, there's a violation of accepted norms, and there's a great deal of danger of this, there being a precedent set here that might be followed by others. My husband did not succeed in getting this published anywhere until he published it within his own shuvot, but he tried to publish it. And sadly, it was considered to be too delicate a question. And he went on, I don't think the word crusade is the politically appropriate word here, but he was on a campaign. He was still in good health at that point, and he delivered this lecture in different places. And he felt if we don't talk out on this. There are going to be other incidents, and this unfortunately was followed by other incidents as a result of rabbis putting their head in the sand. Back to what I'm saying, he dealt with a very broad range of questions. That was an example of a national question. Another example is the rabbi of a community asked him about guarding of fields on Shabbat, where there were Arabs from the neighborhood, not who were endangering, not who were attacking, but who were stealing sheep. And they were using Shabbat as an excuse to steal, to steal sheep. They were doing damage. There were other, many, many other such national kinds of questions. There were a great many questions having to do with women, women in the synagogue, women's Megillah readings, women reciting Kaddish, women and Zimun. The list is a very, very long list. I think he was one of the more prominent voices in this field. And then there were many highly personal questions. And here, it was very important to understand what type of community the question was coming from. And that's why he would always specify to the rabbi of the community or to a member of a community and onwards. I will give you an example of a wonderful tshuva, a very early tshuva, in which he would not have been able to criticize the rabbi had he specified his names, his name. One more thing that I will read to you before I start looking with you at Shuvot is something very interesting, which is the Haskamot, the approbations on his first and second volume. By the time he had published was publishing his third volume, approbations were not required. But in the first volume, Rabbi Gedaliah Felder, who is a beloved name, of course, in the Toronto community, the father of the current Rabbi Felder, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Menashe Klein of Brooklyn, Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, Rabbi Avram Kahana Shapira, Rabbi Avram Kahana Shapira and Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, who were chief rabbis of Israel at the same time. That's his first volume. The reason that I point out those approbations is because they come from a very broad range of the community. I really don't know if there's any other sefer of this sort or any other rabbinic responsa that garnered as broad an audience of this. Okay, I said I was going to give you some examples of the responsa, and I'm going to do this orally. This is Siman Hay of the first volume. I don't have this open in front of me, but in Sefaria, there is, if it's important to many people, I can get into Sefaria now and I can share this, or I will simply do this orally. So if I
think orally is fine. I think
orally is fine.
People can look it up if they'd like on their own.
Okay, so this is volume one, Siman Hey, Siman 5, and it is about women who wish to come to shul. Imahot ha-rotzot lavod beit ha-knesset. This is written to Lerav shel Yishuv Echad, the rabbi of a certain community. Now, what I remember from this period of time is that we lived in the north of the country. There weren't that many community rabbis, or rabbis of kibbutzim. In our area, the Beit She'an area, there were none at that time. There was a rabbi in a certain other kibbutz in the north of the country. And this rabbi would send to my husband his weekly sheet that he wrote for his community. My husband would send back to him his weekly sheet. They corresponded with each other in that fashion. And I think often that we have to thank this rabbi for many, many of my husband's tshuvot, because he would become so upset when he would read what this rabbi was telling his community that he would sit down and he would write a tshuva to him. That's what happened in this case. So he says, after he thanks him for sending him his weekly sheets, lo barur li ma shekatav kvodo shebaasher li'imahot shechoshkot nafshan lehitpalel ועל כן מביאות שם את הילדים שמפריעים, טעות היא בידם, כי עבור זה פטרה התורה נשים ממצוות עשה שהזמן גרמה. He says, I don't understand what you wrote. You wrote that the women who are coming to shul, and as a result, little children come into shul and they disturb the davening, those mothers are making a mistake because they don't realize that the Torah freed them from positive time-bound mitzvot so that they could raise the children. And he called upon the women in his community to stay home. If you have little children, your place is not in the shul. If you have little children, your place is at home with the children. And the synagogue needs to be a place for proper comportment. So my husband begins by saying, I don't really understand what you mean when you say they're making the mistake. Now, what could be on your mind? Could it be that you're thinking of the machloket, the controversy between the Rambam and the Ramban, about whether women are required to recite the prayers as written in the prayer book? Rambam holds, Maimonides, that tefillah itself, praying, is from the Torah, but the words of the prayer and the time of the prayer are of rabbinic nature and not of Torah nature, as understood by some of the Achronim, and particularly the Magen Avraham the Magen Avraham is around the beginning of the 18th century, I think, maybe a bit earlier, as understood in the Magen Avraham, by Magen Avraham, that means that women are freed from the responsibility of praying the words that are written in the Siddur. They're obligated to pray. And a woman can be yotzei, can fulfill her mitzvah by saying whatever prayer to God she wishes to say. In a later tshuva, my husband explains why he believes the Magen Avraham's reading of the Rambam is wrong. But at this point, he's not getting into that. At this point, he simply says, maybe what you're thinking is that the women don't know about the position of Rambam, and that's why they're coming to shul. He says, but you know what? Most of the other Rishonim don't agree with Rambam. So you can't accuse women of making a mistake. Maybe they're holding by the majority. You hear the unspoken rebuke to this rabbi who's not paying attention to the fact that the majority don't hold like Rambam. So he's rebuking the women. And what are you rebuking the women for for following the majority? But then he goes on and he says, for myself, I believe that women today are going out into every field of endeavor. Women are out there. And halavai that they should be in shul. And they will be inspiring the next generation by the sense of uplift that they receive in the shul. And then he quotes his grandfather. He asked his grandfather once, how can it be that the king, oh, thank you. Magen Avraham is 16th, 17th century, as said. Thank you. The he asked his grandfather, how can it be that the kings of Judea, there would be a righteous king who had an evil king as a son, who had a righteous king as a son. How could it be? So his grandfather answered, well, there were queens. The men didn't raise the children alone. The women raised the children as well. In other words, you need to have participation of both parents in religious life if you expect this to be passed on to their children, or you wish to have. And then he goes on to say, listen, there was a custom in Ashkenaz in the Middle Ages that women, menstruating women did not come to synagogue until they had used the mikveh. And Trumat Hadeshen, Rav Yisrael Iserlein, this is the 15th century, the beginning of the 15th century, writes that although that is our custom, we should not be practicing this on the high holy days, because then it would cause women pain to feel excluded from the community, that here all of the community are going to shul and these women are not part of the community, who are feeling the sense of religious uplift on the high holy days. This is quoted by the Ramah, who codified Ashkenazi rulings, but it's very interesting when the Ramah quoted it, my husband points out, he says the women would experience great pain, a great sense of privation. My husband points out that's not what Trumat Hadeshen said. He left out that word great. He said a sense of privation. In other words, you don't need great privation on the part of women in order for you to be ready to come and address their needs. It's enough to have a sense of privation, not great privation. So he goes on from there to say that it's true that the Vilna Gaon said to his daughters, you shouldn't go to shul, because shul was a place for coffee clutching of the women. If you know anything about the way medieval synagogues were constructed, very often you couldn't hear anything from the women's section. He says, but in your community, I'm sure no one talks in shul. And therefore, why don't you just organize Torahnut? Why don't you go out and do something? You should be, rather than telling the women to stay home, what you should be doing is organizing to address their needs. And I think this is I think this is a wonderful beginning. This was one of his earliest tshuvot. I was asked when I studied this by my students, was that your feeling? Did you feel a sense of privation? And I said, no, I didn't. And then I started thinking, it's really marvelous. My husband's wife did not feel a sense of privation. For me, the religious tie has always been learning. And therefore, as long as I'm learning, the once a week meeting with the synagogue is something that was certainly cherished, but not central in my religious life. But for my husband, it didn't need to be central for his wife. The point of it is, are there women for whom this is central? There was something I wanted to say before, and I think this brings home what I was saying before about a posek and a posek's bringing from a particular community. My husband's bio is interesting. He did not attend yeshiva elementary school. He went to public school. His parents were living in New Haven, Connecticut. They did not, there wasn't a day school that they wished to send their son to. So he attended public school and his Judaic schooling was at home. I don't know if it's what we would call today homeschooling, which is already, you know, something so formal and organized, but he certainly learned at home. He attended a co-ed high school, the Yeshiva of Flatbush. Thereafter, he went to Yeshivat Keren B'Yavne in Israel. I'm told that at Yeshivat Keren B'Yavne, he was like a pillar in the Beit Midrash, in the sense that you came in the morning and he was already there. He was sitting at his own table in the Beit Midrash. He explained this, that there were very few tables in the Beit Midrash, and he wanted a table to put all his Sfarim down on. But he was there. He was a permanent fixture in the Beit Midrash. Afterwards, he went back to the United States. He studied at Columbia. He did his first degree in comparative religions at Columbia. He was in the middle of his second degree, and he said, "My grandfather is not going to live forever." And from one day to the next, he dropped out of graduate studies at Columbia and sat with his grandfather. In other words, moved from Columbia University into, I would say, Lithuania. His grandfather was living on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, but the heritage was that of the of Lithuanian Jewry, and he studied with his grandfather morning and afternoon, several hours, day by day by day, for 5 years. Eventually, he returned to Columbia and finished his degree, but his learning was from his grandfather. But I think the fact that he was exposed, that he came from a particular milieu, he didn't grow up in an exclusively Jewish milieu, that enabled him to see broadly. When we came to Israel, so we settled first in the Sephardi community in Beit She'an, where we were amongst a very small population of Ashkenazi Jews. And all of these life's experiences factored in understanding who the community was, and there was great respect for women who were reaching high. I'll give you another example of a tshuva that is in the first volume. It has to do with the husband's presence in the delivery room. This was written in, let's see, 19 Tavshin Lamed Zayin, which is 1977, Kaf Tammuz 1977, and it's L'Rav Shel Yishuv Echad. If any of you have a memory that reaches many, many years back, you may remember the old Shaarei Tzedek. It's a magnificent building, one of Jerusalem's landmarks. It wasn't great for a hospital, but it's a marvelous piece of architecture on Rehov Yafo. And when the new Shaarei Tzedek was built, there was heralding of the fact that now in Israel there were being introduced individual delivery rooms. When I gave birth to our first child in Israel, I gave birth in Poria Hospital, where there was this big labor delivery room, and there were curtains between the different women who were giving birth. There wasn't very much privacy. And Shaarei Tzedek had come forth at that time. Lamaze was becoming popular, and Shaarei Tzedek was going to have an arrangement where her husband could be present in the delivery room, except that the rabbi of Shaarei Tzedek got up and announced a pasuk from the book of Shmot, "Lo kanashim hamitzriyot ha'ivriyot ki chayot eina b'terem tavo elehem hamyaledet v'yaladu." The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They deliver spontaneously before the mialedet, before the
midwife.
Thank you. Before the midwife arrives, they have already given birth. So the rabbi said what was then very much the approach, I think, of rabbis in Israel. There weren't many rabbis in the 1970s who had a college education. I think you could probably count them on one hand. This has changed totally. But at that time, when I started teaching in the high school in Beit She'an, the principal did not yet have a college degree. Even the principal of the high school, let alone all the teachers, he looked at me with, I think, with a sense of awe, because I came with a graduate degree and he didn't have a college degree. So the rabbi barred husbands from the delivery room. And that predicated this. There was correspondence with other rabbis about this. My husband spoke to that rabbi directly. And what my husband did was bring a Gemara in Shabbat. This Gemara in Shabbat talks about violating Shabbat for the purpose of a birthing woman, a woman giving birth. And one of the illustrations is that after the Mishnah tells us that we violate Shabbat to assist the woman giving birth, the Gemara says, for instance, if the woman needs a candle lit for her, we light a candle on Shabbat. Now, that's one of the 39 prohibited melachot on Shabbat. And the Gemara says we light a candle. The Gemara then says, Pshita, it's clear that we light a candle because we've heard that we violate Shabbat for a woman giving birth. So obviously we light a candle. And the Gemara then answers, no. We're talking about lighting a candle for a blind woman, a blind yoledet, a blind woman who's giving birth. Now, the blind woman who's giving birth doesn't need the candle. Why does she want the candle? Because she's concerned that those who are attending her may not have enough light to fulfill her needs properly. So as part of the tension surrounding childbirth, she wants a candle to be lit. And the Gemara tells us not that we tell her we've lit the candle and we don't light the candle. She doesn't need the candle. We don't need the candle. It's broad daylight. The lighting of the candle is superfluous. And nevertheless, halacha requires us to light that candle, lest she find out that we didn't light the candle for her. Someone might come into the room and she might say, be careful, there's a candle burning. And the person may say, oh, there's no candle burning. And then she'll panic. The Gemara teaches us about Yishuv Hada'at Biyoledet, that Yishuv Hada'at, the settling of the mind, the feeling calm, is critical for a woman giving birth. So my husband argues, this is a long tshuva with as usual, references, many numerous references from the Rishonim and from Achronim. But my husband's basic argument is this, that the woman who's giving birth is different from others who are ill. For someone who is critically ill, we perform everything that that person needs. But if the person doesn't need it, then we're not going to light the candle. But for a yoledet, we are going to light that candle. If the person needs it, someone who's critically ill, of course we'll light the candle. But if it's unnecessary, we'll do it for the yoledet, because for the yoledet, there's a specific factor, which is called yishuv hada'at, the having a settled mind. And my husband said, why is that? He says, because a woman has to participate in the birth process. She needs to conserve her strength for that part of the birth process where she's going to have to push, perhaps for a very long time. She needs to be able to push when she needs to push and to refrain from pushing when she needs to refrain from pushing. And therefore, for a yoledet, the yishuv hada'at, her being calm, her being collected, her feeling reassured, is of greater importance than anyone else who is ill. And therefore, he says, when the rabbi prohibits the husband from being present, because a woman who is giving birth, there is bleeding, and she is already considered nida from a certain stage, and the husband should not be looking at her private parts. My husband says as follows. His argument is correct if she doesn't want him there. But if she wants him there, he is not permitted to absent himself. He is obligated, not he's permitted to be there, but he's obligated to be there. And he says a hospital which prevents the husband from being part of the delivery is endangering the life of the woman. He speaks very, very strongly about that, that the hospital is not permitted halachically to bar the husband, the husband's presence. Okay, let's go on from there to a few more tshuvot. Volume 2. One second. Volume 2, there's an interesting short. Where is it? Yes, there. The volume 2, Siman Lamed He, Siman 35, there's a short tshuva, which I think is reflective of his attitude. It's l'rav echad. A certain rabbi sent him something that he wanted him to read, and I see the question: did Shari Tzedek change its policy as a result? I don't know when the change in Shari Tzedek's policy occurred. I do know that I have two daughters and one daughter-in-law who gave birth at Shari Tzedek, and in all cases, the husband was present. So the policy changed, but this goes back decades. but there's no question in that in many cases, my husband's true vote changed the landscape, no question about it. And the public does not always know this because my husband corresponded with rabbis, and rabbis would rely upon his psak for their own psak. Individuals also corresponded with him or spoke with him. Here's a tshuva about inflated titles for rabbis. This rabbi was using titles of grandeur to refer to other rabbis, and this is very, very, very common in every time we get used to a title, so there's some grand new title that's crowning the rabbi as the rabbi of the whole world. So my husband says as follows: if you want to do that in a personal letter to a rabbi, so go ahead and do it. Whether it's worthy or not worthy, I'm not going to argue with you on that. But when you do this publicly, you run the danger of two things. One of them is, if your titles describing this rabbi are too grand, people are likely to rely upon him. They may not understand his stature. And therefore, you shouldn't be doing that. We should be respecting, but not inflating the titles. He said also, these people may be chosen for office as a result of the fact that titles become progressively more inflated. And he gives an example of a certain rabbi of a city who is an excellent rabbi, but he wasn't a gadol b'torah, And once he was elected the rabbi of the city, then the titles began pouring in upon him. And this wasn't something that my husband thought should be. Let's see what is here. There's a tshuva in the second volume about ceding land in Israel for peace. This is not a political tshuva. It's a halachic tshuva. Is the government permitted to make a call on this issue? Or is this issue a halachic issue? And he, after citing, as was his wont, a long string of authorities, everything, all of his tshuvot begin with a tour of the Rishonim, the early authorities. He had a very fine collection of Rishonim, and they were typically covering the entire table. He didn't use the computers, any search engine to find his tshuvot. The books were open on the table. So after going through the relevant halachic sources, he says this is not a halachic decision. Not everything in life is governed by halacha. This is a decision that is a government decision. And he ends, of course, after saying the government is permitted. That doesn't mean that this step is wise or unwise. It means that the government is permitted to act as it sees fit. And he ends with a prayer that Hashem give wisdom in the heart of our leaders to know what is the way of truth and peace, and our leaders should also, our chachamim should also know what to write and what not to write. This does not have to do with his own feeling of whether ceding land is a good thing or a bad thing. It has to do with, do you argue that the government is doing something which is illegitimate, or is it legitimate? And he argued it's legitimate. You can approve or disprove it, but it is legitimate. There is a tshuva here. I'm looking at some of the shorter tshuvot that has to do with it's written to a Shoel Echad, and this person was asking, can you rely upon the Shechita of Lubavitcher Shochet, who believes that the Rebbe is Mashiach, that the Rebbe, may he rest in peace, was Mashiach. So what my husband writes is as follows: Masher Rabim Michasidav Medamim Shehagaon Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson Zal, Hu Melech HaMashiach, Hu Hevel Vishtut. He says, believing the Rebbe is Mashiach after his death is stupidity. But I don't understand, he says, the application of the word heresy to this. Halohem mitzapim l'mashiach. Bavitcher Hasidim are awaiting Mashiach. Umayich patlan shalatam hatoa kvar haya v'meit v'atid lichyot shuv lichmok. What does it bother us if they think that, okay, Mashiach appeared and he died and he's going to come again? Sof hey mitzapim l'mashiach. At the bottom line, as far as heresy goes, is they are awaiting Mashiach. And he says, he brings a daya in the Gemara of Rabbi Hillel that he didn't await Mashiach. He said, "Ein Mashiach l'Israel shekvar achluhu b'nei Chizkiyah." And he says that when they attempt to identify Mashiach as a particular person, it's as silly as someone who says Mashiach has to have red hair. Rabbi Kelman, forgive me. I'm just reading, that's what he says here. It's as foolish as saying Mashiach has to have red hair and he has to weigh this and this much. That's all. Elehem divrei hevel ushtut. This is not heresy. This is stupidity. And you are, if the man shechts properly, you can rely upon his shechita. If he keeps a kosher home, you can eat in his home. In other words, don't be so quick to disqualify Jews on the basis of what's foolhardy. If it's foolhardy, recognize that it's foolish. Recognize that it's stupid. But don't inflate the terms that you're using and turn stupidity into heresy. It's not heresy. It's just plain stupidity. I will give another example, which is a wonderful example. We're drawing towards the end of our time. It has to do with women's Megillah reading. I think this is in volume 2. I don't have it open in front of me now. I'm stating this orally. Women's Megillah readings is something very interesting. If you go through, if you look at the Gemara in Arachim says, Hakol chayavim b'mikra Megillah. All are required in the reading of Megillah. And whenever the Gemara has the word all, a generalization, the Gemara typically asks, what does all come to include? The word all comes to include a category that we might otherwise have thought was excluded, and we need to include. And the Gemara answers it comes to include women. Women are also obligated in the reading of Megillah. As distinct from the Gemara, the Tosefta, which is a collection of Mishnayot that were not incorporated in the Talmud, says women are obligated to hear the Megillah. They're not obligated to read the Megillah. They're obligated to hear the Megillah. Now, when we have two texts, we have the Talmud that says women are obligated to read the Megillah. Men are obligated, women are obligated, all are obligated to read the Megillah. And we have a parallel text, which was not incorporated in the Talmud, it's in the Tosefta, that says women are exempt from the reading of Megillah. They're obligated to hear the Megillah. What do we do? So my husband says, well, there are two ways of dealing with that, and that's what you have in the Rishonim. One way is to say which of the two texts is authoritative, and we say that the Talmudic text is authoritative. The other is to try to reconcile the two texts. Those who take the path of saying the Talmud is authoritative, in other words, women are obligated to read the Megillah. In other words, if a woman reads for a man, the man fulfills the mitzvah, because whenever the mitzvah is identical, another person can fulfill the mitzvah, can be your shaliach for an array of mitzvot. But that's only if the obligation is identical. So Rashi, Rambam, and a long string of Rishonim all say the Talmud is authoritative. In other words, a woman can read the Megillah for a man. There's in the 9th century, the Baal Halachot Gedolot said, try to reconcile the two. And the Baal Halachot Gedolot said, the Talmud is dealing with one mitzvah when it says all are obligated. the Talmud considers women obligated to hear. When the Tosefta says women are exempt, it's dealing with the mitzvah of reading, and women are exempt from reading, but they're obligated to hear. In that fashion, he reconciles both. If you go to any of the yeshivot today, and you say, can a woman read Megillah for other women? I'm not talking about, can women read for men? Can women read for other women? Most yeshiva students will say, the Mishnah Brura says a woman can read for herself, but not for other women. Actually, if they were being precise, they would say in Shar HaTziyun, the Mishnah Brura quotes Karban Netanel, Rabbi Netanel Weil, who lived in the 18th century, who said a woman cannot read for other women. So my husband looked at this and he said, something here is fishy. How does this happen? You have a machloket rishonim in which the question is, can a woman read for a man or not? There's no question that a woman can read for other women. And suddenly Karban HaTanil was printed in 1766, the 18th century. In the 18th century, suddenly you have a view that women cannot read for other women. So to make a very long story short, he goes back and he finds two readings in the name of the Halachot Gedolot that I cited for you. Halachot Gedolot comes from the 9th century. The one is what I cited for you, that there's a difference in the obligation of men and women, and therefore a woman can't read for men. However, the tour wrote for us the tour who was 13th, 14th century cites something different in the name of Bahag, Baal Halachot Gedolot, and that's that the women and men have the same obligation, level of obligation. However, a woman should not read for men, and there are various reasons given for this. Going back to the Karban Netanel, Rabbi Netanel, while my husband demonstrates why he's making a mistake in the Bahag, and basically it's because there was a book called Tosfot Harosh that he didn't read. He wrote a commentary on Rabbeinu Asher the Rosh, that's the 13th, 14th century, but he didn't see the Rosh's commentary on Tosfot, or rewriting of Tosfot, actually, which enabled him to make a mistake. I think summarizing the main points, but to read this, you have to go back to the original Tshuva, and in one of my husband's books in English called Equality Lost, he has a clear rendition of this. For time reasons, I'm not going into it. So my husband commented as follows. How did Karban Netanel misread the Rosh? The Rosh was so clear that women cannot read for the many, meaning harabim, meaning men. He was not talking about women reading for women. How did Karban Netanel, Rabbi Netanel Weil, miss this? His answer was that Rabbi Netanel Weil never saw Tosfot HaRosh, because Rabbi Netanel Weil lived in, as I said, in the 18th century. Tosfot HaRosh was in manuscript form. It was only printed in 1903. Mishnah Brura didn't see it either. Mishnah Brura started being published in 1883. Had they seen, they wouldn't have made this mistake. What you have here is calling of history to explain to us how suddenly in the 18th century, after years in which the question is, can women read for men? And you have a lineup, including Rashi and Rambam, that say women can read for men, that suddenly a woman can't read for other women based upon a mistake that can be forgiven because Rabbi Nathanael Weil, who was a rabbi in Prague, did not have access to what we have access today. So a book that became printed, the book went back to the 14th century, but the book was not in print until our times. So I've given you a little bit of a look into some of the tshuvot of my husband. What I wish to say is that I have a hope, I have a prayer, that our community will demand of its rabbis to be truthful. I think that people are able to accept when a rabbi says this is permitted, this is prohibited. I don't think people expect a rabbi to permit everything. But I don't think people wish to have a rabbi deceive them, trick them. Language is something which is very precious to us Jews. And language should be used carefully, sparingly, accurately. And we as a community should be demanding that from our poskim. We should be demanding from our poskim that they be not just rabbinically erudite, but familiar with life. I want to give you one more example, and I'll end with this. A woman wrote to my husband saying, this is in his fourth volume, saying, I've been studying Torah for 4 years, above and beyond my college education. I'm getting married. I would like to have a friend recite one of the blessings, one of the brachot, one of the sheva brachot under the chuppah. And she wrote saying, every rabbi I've asked is not able to give me a reason why not, but they say we don't do it. And she said, is it permitted? So my husband's answer to her was what I would call a nuanced answer. He said to her, it should not be done because the sanctity of the ritual should be preserved as it is. However, you can do A, B, C, and D to enable a woman's presence to be felt at your wedding. You can have a woman reading your ketubah. You can have a woman doing the announcing. It's very interesting in contemporary, in my students' marriages in Israel, this is becoming common that the sister of the bride, rather than the brother of the bride, the sister of the bride announces who the luminaries are who are coming up or makes any announcements or gives a Dvar Torah. My husband gave a list of what is permissible. He didn't leave her with, you can't do this. He certainly did not rebuke her. If you go back to the first illustration of the rabbi rebuking the women who wanted to come to shul and saying, that's not your place. He did not rebuke her. He respected her question. He respected where she was coming from. He didn't compromise his own opinion, but he, if you look at that tshuva, it's a wonderful tshuva. He repeats her question in his own language. He gives her the respect of stating his opinion. And then he discusses not just what is prohibited, but what is permissible. So I think we as a community should be asking this of our rabbinic scholars, we should be asking of them not to be looking over their shoulder, not their left shoulder, not their right shoulder, not to be hindered by what is going to be said. A young rabbi sat with my husband a number of times over the last year. He's writing a book about psychology, about medical psychological situations in halakha. Very, very touchy personal situations. He asked my husband a question, and my husband had Parkinson's. His speech was slow. It was hard to decipher at the end. This rabbi said to me, I was sitting on your living room rug. I was not home when this was taking place. I was at Mishmat. I didn't even know this was taking place, as was the case with many questions that came to our house. I didn't have a clue of who was coming in the door and who was asking questions. So this young rabbi said to me after my husband passed away, I sat down on the rug. I couldn't write. I was taking notes and I couldn't write with my notebook on my lap. So you have a coffee table, and it was convenient for me to sit on the floor. Rabbi Henkin was sitting in the armchair. I was sitting Lamar Gulotav. I was sitting at his feet. I was sitting on the floor. I did it for convenience, but I was aware that this reflected a position of myself sitting next to the stage. And I asked him my questions, and I did this over the course of several visits. I got to one question which was extremely sensitive. And I asked his opinion, and he was quiet for a couple of minutes, and I was quiet. I waited, and he was thinking. And he was the first rabbi to permit what I was asking. And I said to him, Rabbi Henkin, you know, I'm planning to write this. You could be attacked for this. May I write it? And again, my husband was quiet for a little while, and he said, yes. And this young rabbi said, and if they attack you? And my husband said, so they'll attack me. Now, the book hasn't yet been published, so we await to see what will be. But we as a community have the right to demand integrity from our rabbis. We have a right to demand of them that they speak to us begova einayim. They speak to us respectfully, whether the decision is going to come down as we would want it or not is a separate question, because we're coming to them as experts. But we wish as a community to be respected. My prayer is that there's a legacy here which will become a handbook for our community, and that our community will begin producing post-kim. Our community will do so when we have individuals who are meet the many qualifications, including being fearless. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope you have a couple minutes for questions, because we really want to thank you for that, and the personal and professional, and the what makes a posek. And, you know, the Gemara says that when you quote a person who's no longer in this world, siftov tov tov bekever, the lips of the deceased move in the ground as they quote his Torah. So I think you have your husband's lips moving bekever, and it's really... You know, Torah, as you said, Torah links this world and the next world. So I want to thank you, really, for speaking on on a personal level and for bringing to light some of your husband's important tshuvot. So I'll read a couple of the questions. They're not too many, but you've sort of addressed this, but being a fearless posek, how much did he take into account other poskim and his originality? And yes, I think it is quite nice. I can do all the questions at once. That probably is a better idea. What you mentioned at the beginning, all the people who quoted him, but how his originality, his willingness to take on other poskim, and like even now you said at the end, he was wronged. Am I going to have run misunderstood the Korban Netanel, etc.? That's one question. Just let me quickly go through the other questions. Dispute between the Rambam and Kedat you discussed. Shaarei Tzedek changing the policy you mentioned, of course. I don't know if you want to address this. Somebody wants to know how you met your husband, where you grew up. I don't know. Robert, your husband was in KBYC in 61, 62. Somebody wanted to know when they were there. That's pretty much it. The woman, Ksuva, the people answered some of the questions that as they were being asked. And after you finish that, we'll, if somebody wants to ask out, ask them to speak up, but maybe you want to address those really one question.
I'll try to do this fairly quickly. How much does he quote other poskim? Greatly. He always begins a tshuva with Rishonim. It goes back to the Gemara. One of his great joys in life was finding books that we didn't have. And we shared a love of books. Before we married, I declared my criteria at the top of the list was he's got to have Sfarim. I did not realize the extent to which this was going to fill up every spare wall space in our home, or every spare space. But he had a fine collection. We did. Actually, we would buy each other gifts, the sefer that each one of us wanted. So my gifts to him would be something I wanted. His gifts to me would be something he wanted. He would always go through all the Rishonim. He also went through the Achronim, but what in cases where he felt that he needed to disagree with that he felt that a mistake was being made, like for instance by Rav Moshe Feinstein, he would state that. And the remarkable thing is Rav Moshe Feinstein nevertheless gave him an approbation on his sefer. So that's an expression of the greatness of Rabbi Feinstein, the greatness of other rabbis. It's true not only of these two rabbis. Some of the people who gave him haskamot, he disagreed with very strongly regarding a specific point. And nevertheless, Talmidei Chachamim can continue as people who appreciate and admire each other. So yes, he does mention contemporary poskim, and he makes his call. I don't know what I was being asked about his originality, but certainly there was originality. I don't know what the question was. He was in Kerem Biavne, maybe in 1966. I'm not sure exactly. Not as early as 1962. I shouldn't say because I don't remember. I don't remember the date. I know that in 67 he was back in the United States, but maybe it goes back earlier than that. Have we met? We were both in a youth movement together. A youth movement, now defunct youth movement. It's called Mizrahi Yatzair.
Uh-huh. That was a good way for people to meet. Well, that's good. They've gone away. I don't know. Maybe I can ask you. Did your husband? I know. B'nai Akiva in Israel has gone very unisex from a co-ed, from what I understand. Did he write about that? If I can ask.
No, he didn't write about that.
But he did he have anything to say about that? I mean, if you don't want to ask, I don't want to put you on the spot, but
you're not putting me on the spot. He did not write about that, and I don't remember a conversation about that.
Okay. Because listen, it's harder for people to, that's what we don't get on the whole shidduch scene, but that there aren't the opportunities. I think, you know, that your generation was very, you know, that's how people met. And of course, there was never a mechitza at a wedding. That was unheard of, you know, but anyways. Okay, if anybody would like to ask any questions, one or two questions for a moment, otherwise we'll really let Rabbi Nitenka go and thank her again. But
can I ask a question?
Sure.
Okay. First of all, very briefly, when my grandmother passed away, I found a very large donation to Rabbi Henkin, your father-in-law, which was
grandfather-in-law,
which was the middleman was Rabbi Felder Sr. I was astounded by the amount because my grandmother, as long as I knew her, never worked a day. So I was just astounded as to how he got her to get that kind of money. The other thing I wanted to point out is I was a student at a school where Hebrew language was pretty much zero. I came to Israel. I heard a shoemaker speak to an Arab merchant. It was terrible. And I thought to myself, mine's even worse. So I had reached a stage where I was getting confused between the accent I picked up when I was very young and learning Hebrew. And it wasn't worth it for me. I was just getting too confused. So I switched over and prayed in Hebrew. So I remember this one time I had a yard site for one of my parents and I prayed in the modern Hebrew and the rabbi came over to me and told me you're not allowed to. And I remember reading an article by Rabbi Henkin, I think it was your husband, in that Torah journal that comes out every year. It means Tzomet, where he's basically said that you are supposed to pray in Hebrew, in the modern Hebrew language, if you're familiar with it. And so I decided I wasn't going to tell the rabbi, but I felt as though my behavior had been reinforced.
I'm very glad to hear that your behavior was reinforced. Regarding the contribution to the saintly great Rabbi Henkin that Rabbi Gedalia Felder garnered, it was a contribution not to him personally, obviously, but to Ezra's Torah.
Ezra's Torah.
Yeah, it was to Ezra's Torah. And there were many rabbinic partners. The greatest rabbis of the generation were partners in this. One of the things that my husband could not countenance was when Parshat Zachor would be read in shul in different fashions so that whatever community you came from, you could be Yotze. And my husband would walk out of shul after the first reading he would come back to shul for Musa, but he would not stay there because he would say, what are you doing? You're disqualifying Jews. You mean a Jew who's Ashkenazi can't hear a Sephardi pronunciation and a Sephardi can't hear an Ashkenazi pronunciation. And there are places today where I've heard that they take pride in the fact that they have 9 different readings. And it sounds inclusive, but it isn't inclusive. It's precisely the opposite. It's we can't be Yotze with someone who's a little different from us. Why not? We're all Jews.
That's Dr. Sokolow, who gives our weekly Haftorah shir, says that we have every Wednesday night, said that they don't let him lane like Parshat Zachor because he refuses to lane it more than once. He doesn't even go for Zecher, forget the different. But anyways, but okay, it is late. It's almost 9 o'clock in Israel. You've been on for a long time. We greatly appreciate it. The many people appreciate it. And you should continue in your wonderful work at Nishmat and all the work, and continue, you know, now on your own, I guess. It's, but really wish you much hatzlach and harbatza Torah, that you've done so well. And really, and it's nice you addressed many of the women's issues, of course, which is such an important issue for our generation. And we look forward to learning with you again in the future. And thank you very much. Everybody be well.
Thank you.
Tomorrow morning, of course, Malka Simkowitz at 11 a.m. Eastern time.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow night, Mark Shapiro, all our regular, you know, shiurim. I think we've got 12 shiurim this week on the E-Team. So everybody, welcome. We look forward to learning with you. And everybody be well and have a wonderful day. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I see people who are very dear to me, and I'm not going to say names.
As long as
I'm delighted to see your faces. Online,
we'll keep the Zoom open, people. Yeah, this is part of how we create a community. A little before, we schmooze afterwards. Mm-hmm. Everybody can stay and talk as long as they'd like. So,
Rabbanit Henkin, it was wonderful to see you.
Shelly, how are you? Nice to see you.
Shelly, you live. You've lived in Maale Adumim for many years. Is that
no,
correct?
My sister's living in Maale Adumim. Oh, we're in Jerusalem. Right.
You're in Jerusalem.
Yes.
How nice to see you. How nice to see you.
Okay.
I see Barbara Banks,
so
who I haven't seen in years.
So good to see you. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I think it's been a long time since
we missed your regular visits to Toronto.
Thank you, Barbara.
Come back again. We'd love to see
Thank you. Toronto is a community very dear to me. Thanks to Esther Sacknowitz. Esther Sacknowitz was
warm regards
around my screen. So I say, and I see Marcia, you are here from Israel or from LA? I'm sorry, you're muted. I can't hear you.
Maybe after Pesach.
Good. Travel safely. So I wish, and I see Hannah Baumgarten. Shalom. And of course, I see Rabbi Uri and Dr. Yocheved, I almost said Engelberg, which is a couple of years ago. Dr. The Cohen family, shalom, great honor to see you here. And Gita Zivotofsky, I see. Oh my goodness, Benji Silverberg, shalom. How nice to see faces, so many faces. Shalom to everybody. May we have good news. And Rabbi Kelman, thank you so much. And thank you as well for giving us a wonderful student for the next class of Yoatzot Halacha.
Thank you. Our pleasure. Thank you.
I can give you a tshuva that I don't think was ever written up, but it happened to me personally when I came to be Menachem Avil at your house. And I spoke to the Rav. You were off in the other room or on the Mirpeset, and I talked to him and told him that my granddaughters were going to have a joint bat mitzvah at which there would be a Torah reading by the women, by them. And the question was that I put to him, what should the women who get aliyot, what should they say? I didn't ask him whether he approved of that. Mm-hmm. We had decided that that's what we're going to do. And the question is, there were different texts in the Georgetown Synagogue, in the Woodside, in the Kemp Mill Synagogue,
in the Washington area,
what brachot should be made by the women who get aliyot. And he got up very excited and ran off and looked at a Sfard Siddur, which was in the library on the shelf over there, I think obviously thinking that it was, he had in mind some kapitel of Tillim that would be appropriate. He didn't find it in the Siddur, And then at that point, I think the Sephardi chief rabbi came in to be Menachem Oval, and the whole room kind of switched around, and you came in and sat next to him at the Nichum Avelim, and I was sort of in the back row. So I thought, well, okay, I had told him he could send me an email with an answer to what should be said. And I felt, okay, I'll leave.
No, I want to look better. It's not that I
And what look. Happened was, I before I left, when the chief Sephardi chief rabbi left, and I thought I was leaving, suddenly one of your granddaughters came over to me with a Tanakh, apparently, which he had marked off, to show me chapter Kuf Lamed Dalid, I think, in Tillim, which has three psukim. And he then came over to me and said, those are the psukim that should be said if there are women getting aliyot. And it's interesting, there are three psukim, which have Baruch Hu, I think, in the first pasuk, and then other psukim, two others. And those are the three psukim that he said should be said if we do that. And we did do that when our granddaughters had bat mitzvah in Washington, when they came back, a joint bat mitzvah. And the men sat behind the machitza, and the women had a davening, and they leaned. We said those three psukim, which he had singled out as being the ones that should be said when the women got the aliyot. And
they're very similar. He probably, Dr. Lewin, thank you so much for coming to our shiva. That's obviously the shiva when our son and daughter-in-law were murdered. The one word that I would change is he probably said that he would recommend those psukim, not that those needed to be said, but that he felt that those were fine psukim to say for an aliyah. What he felt, he advised a group of women here in Jerusalem who had for many years had a women's tefillah, and whereas he was not promoting it. He saw himself as someone who was a resource, who was prepared to assist and very happy to assist. And what he did not wish to see was a bogus Birkat HaTorah recited. Save your Birkat HaTorah, don't say it at the beginning of the tefillot. He didn't wish to see that, but he felt that there were wonderful texts which could be recited, which would be deeply significant spiritually.
I agree. I think he only recommended it. He didn't ask him that this was what should be said, but
he recommended, and
that's what he recommended. And then the interesting thing is that when I subsequently told this whole story of this event at your house to Rabbi Chanoch Yeris, who was the rabbi in Yamin Moshe, is the rabbi in Yamin, he said that I didn't realize, but that was a very useful thing to have said to him at that point when you were sitting shiva, that really sort of aroused him, which it did. I mean, I was astounded that when I was sitting there and I just asked the question, suddenly he jumped up and ran off to find the answer to the question I had asked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was not purporting to be any kind of authority or any kind of lamdan or anything. I just asked the question.
Did he know who you were?
I don't recall. I said I was a lawyer in Washington. I think he said he had heard of me, but there was no.
Yes,
I was not a lamdan. I wasn't somebody who was, you know.
Your reputation travels far, Dr. Lewin.
even giving me the title doctor is something that only Harvard Law School did belatedly after. Many years after we graduated with an LLB, they changed to JD. So it's only in Europe, if the lawyers come to Europe, that they're called doctors. Mm-hmm. Dr. Lewin, Zichrono Livracha, was my father. He deserved the title doctor. I don't.
Rabbi Nidhenkin?
Yes. Adina Rafkas, it was such a pleasure, and I'm so glad we were able to tune in. And I hope I get to speak to you personally before Pesach.
Thank you, Adina.
Hi.
I just,
you're very precious to me.
This is Judy Sokolow. I'm wondering if you remember me from all these years ago at Central.
Oh, shalom, Judy.
Jim Sussman.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah. Indeed. So I just wanted to say hi.
You're Judy Sussman from the Lower East Side.
I was, and now I'm Judy Sokolow from the Upper West Side. And I really, really enjoyed this this presentation.
Thank you.
Very, very much.
Thank you. Yes,
I just, I very often think of a discussion that occurred as we were, I can't remember if it was still during Shloshim that we visited you and Rav Henkin in your residence after the terrible tragedy. And unrelated to that, as we left, he approached me and he said, do you have any knowledge if your Zaidi, Rav Tuvia Geffen of Atlanta, ever had a correspondence with my grandfather? And I've been haunted by the fact that I haven't been able to find a way to approach that question, but I continue to think about it. Many of his original writings, including his famous ketubah about Coca-Cola, were actually in the archives at Emory University with other materials of his. So I keep trying to find a way, so I won't forget his question, as I won't forget as many contributions.
I think that the question had its source in our son, Harav Eitam, who, in the course of going, collecting tshuvot of his great-grandfather, there was some correspondence with Rabbi Geffen. So I think it's our son who raised the issue, and I was delighted when the issue was raised because I said, that's Heschel Raskus's grandfather.
Right.
So the connection goes, the connection with the Raskus family is multi-generational.
If there's any opportunity to know about what year that reference might have occurred, there might be some chance to inquire a bit more, but that's probably not.
I don't know. We have a book of our sons. We have a book of our sons, which is going to come out in English translation. It's not his collected works, because collected works implies that it's all of his works, but it's a translation of about 25 articles that were published. That have been translated into English. There may be some mention there of Rabbi Geffen. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
I'm not sure.
With your permission, I'd like to say hello to Nat Lewin, who was in law school at Harvard the first year I was at MIT as an undergraduate when I first met him.
So if Nat Lewin is still here, Nat Lewin is.
He waves.
Yes. All right. Quite a while ago. That was an amazing group of people who were up there at that time. I mean, you know, Yitz Greenberg, Aaron Lichtenstein. I mean, it was an honor roll, really, to be up in Cambridge or in the Boston area at that time, of young people who made a great mark in terms of Jewish life in the succeeding years. So delighted to really have been there at that time. I'm very lucky.
I'm going to apologize because I have actually
I feel bad. I'm sorry, but you're happy to take questions. I really appreciate people are interested. Yes, but we'll let Rabbi Nidhenkin go. And thank you, everybody, very much. And have a wonderful day. Be well. And thank you again.
Shalom to all.
Shalom. Okay, bye-bye, everybody.